I've been waiting for this guy to come into my lair all week. Dr. John Jackson is joining us this morning. John, first off, it's good to see you. It's great to have you in the studio.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm always glad to be with you, and I'm particularly glad to be invited to join this special group that you've had on for this theme that you've been pursuing all week.
Well, I was glad to have you, and it really wasn't much of a stretch to get Dr. John Jackson in. Glenn Pichard, Senator Dave Luckdevelt, Supreme Court Justice Ann Burke, tomorrow Jesse White. But, you know, one of the reasons when people talk to John Jackson, I'll tell you, you have a really interesting story. You know, did you grow up on a farm in Arkansas?
I grew up in deep piney woods, southwest Arkansas, down as close as you can get to Louisiana and Texas, still being in Arkansas. And it was started on a farm and moved to town at age 6, and then grew up in a town of 1,500.
And then to Vanderbilt University.
You had
the work at the Baptist University.
Two Baptist universities. I'm a graduate of Ouachita Baptist.
All right.
And then I got a master's degree at Baylor, so I've got lots of Baptist education. Then I went off to the U.S. Army for a while, and then I went to Vanderbilt.
So what we both know is both John and I can't dance.
That's true. I couldn't dance then because I'm clumsy and don't have any rhythm.
Well, that gave us good reason to be Baptists. Then they started allowing people to have dances. They called them foot functions. Because you may remember that.
Well, my little college called it vertical exercising.
Yeah, but then at the same time, my Baptist minister called it was a vertical manifestation of a horizontal desire.
Oh, wow. Well, that took care of that issue theologically.
Well, when Grandma got to about 85, she asked him if it was okay to, you know, to dance. And she says, you know, you're 85, you can do whatever you want, you know. So okay. It's nice. But, you know, what's interesting is that story. Your story is really an interesting one here. You start in the woods. You go to Vanderbilt. You become a captain in the intelligence division for the U.S. Army. You become a much respected teacher. You kind of epitomize. You and I are both big fans of books. So, do you ever read the Foundation series with Harry Seldon about, you know, psychodynamics in the future? We'd be able to forecast what large groups of people would do. You ever read that?
No, I don't know that particular book.
Well, so there's the idea being that you could do math and understand what people are doing. And I think we've come to that point. I mean, you're a research expert. You would know it better than anybody. But when I look at you, it's a very unique mathematical question. Teaching equals learning equals teachers equals learning. You are teaching and learning constantly throughout your entire life.
Yeah, I was dean of liberal arts for a while, and one of the major themes when you're dean of liberal arts is you want people to become educated so they will be students for life. And I've adopted that, even though I used to preach about it. It didn't go away when I left that office because we in the university really believe that, and we have something called Learning and Retirement at SIU now, and I teach in that series.
But, you know, when I read some of the reviews your students wrote about you online, that, you know, he is kind, he appreciates participation, acknowledges when a good point is made, and his classes stay civil, which is not easy when it's poli-science. You know, you learn. And then a lot of people learn, and then they put up their brick walls, and I know everything. You are not a brick. There's an old analogy, the ocean refuses no river. And you continue, you've never put up walls and say, I know everything. And that's something that's been evidenced to the people you work with and the people you've taught. You are accepting, you're looking out, you're growing all the time. You never stopped.
Well, the world is too organized into tribes and warring camps these days. We don't have the ability to see other people's point of view. We don't have the ability to have empathy for the other person and understand where they're coming from. And we need more of that. And I've always learned from students, and I've learned from my colleagues and from the research that I've done. And I think I know what the facts are, and I think I know what my values are, but I also think that I need to listen to what other people have to say and what they're bringing to the, particularly the political argument. And I taught not only political science, I taught public opinion and political parties and all of those things to lead you to knock down, drag out fights if you're not careful. But try to avoid that.
How do you retain intellectual objectivity?
Well, for one thing, in graduate school, we're really taught what's the difference between facts and values, and you adopt your own opinions, you adopt your own commitments, but you also have to keep that objectivity to stay true to what the facts are. And that's what basic research in political science is about.
All right. This is something I'd hope to start later, but here we are. Policy-based data. I just read that phrase for the first time about 4 or 5 years ago. And I'll read that again. The data wasn't based on data. It was based on policy. Policy-based data. And I think that is really a loaded question. That's a loaded statement. That troubles me a lot. Data's data. Policy's policy. I don't know. Is this kind of a loaded statement?
I think we need public policy that is fact-based, that's based on previous research, that's based on... Let's take a look at program evaluation. What programs have been addressing this problem in the past? What is their record? What did they do right? What did they do wrong? Those are the things that should inform the policy debate.
You know, what's interesting is the messages coming in, and I knew they would. Dr. John Jackson, this is from a retired SIU employee who you and I both know.
Okay.
Phil is calling us this morning and texting in on the American Minute text line. The Dr. John Jackson is one of the kindest, most professional people I've ever worked with in my 30 years of SIU. This is something that is widely echoed when you look up details and reviews about you, and it's whether you're students or whether you're coworkers. And it's interesting because you could use the word gentleman, intellectual, but you know what? I've always gotten the vibe that, you know, manners make the man. Is that something you, especially in the field of teaching, that manners make the man?
Well, I think you have to have the ability to have some sense of empathy for others and be humble enough to know that you don't know it all and that they also know some things that are relevant. I've heard you talk about the ability to treat all of the people that you interview in a decent way and not get into a slugfest with them, and I think that's part of your signature and your reputation. And so I think we've got to the golden rule, the golden rule is you want to be treated by others. You want to treat others the same way you would want to be treated.
Not as popular a concept as it once was.
Well, I think that's right. And you have to not be so narcissistic that you can't see their position. And that keeps you, I think, tolerant.
Is that because you're an optimist?
Yeah, in the long run, I'm a cautious optimist.
Cautious optimist. Yeah. We have to qualify that, yeah. Right? I'm a babbling pessimist. So we can do this. You know, and the reason why I ask this is some of the jobs you've taken on. Because if you weren't an optimist, the genuine effort in which you put into teachers, it's amazing. Because if you listen closely to people's tone and their voice, Dr. John Jackson was my teacher. I like the emphasis when it comes on mine. They've taken ownership. They're proud of the fact they were in the classroom with you. I mean, you did a lot of work for higher education. You were chancellor, and people forget this sometimes. You were chancellor at SIU from 1999 to 2001. Before that, the vice chancellor for academic affairs, the provost from 96 to 99. We already talked about your time at Baylor, at Vanderbilt, at a couple of Baptist universities. I mean, if you're a young person who grew up, I mean, you were president of the faculty senate in 1969. There was no turbulence in 1969 at SIU. Quiet year, nothing happened.
Yeah, right.
You know, 50 years of teaching, you know, when it comes to this. And I find that fascinating that you keep, to me, that illustrates, you know, your willingness to teach. But at the same time, as I said, I'm a pessimist. I kind of go with that knowledge equals fear equation sometimes, too. and you don't seem to succumb to that.
No, I think the more knowledge we can get as a society, as a country, and as individuals, the better. On my career, I started as a faculty member. I've come back to being a faculty member at the end of my career, and I treasured being a faculty member first. Then I became an administrator for 22 years, which is a long stretch at SIU, and to stayed at the same place. But the administrators, no matter what your job is, are supposed to create the conditions where students can learn and teachers can teach. That's what we're about as administrators.
Creating an environment.
Create the environment.
Say, yeah.
Yeah. And
that's harder than ever now.
Yeah, it is.
The polarized efforts.
Yeah, but 1969, the place shut down.
Right.
And
National Guard.
You know, yeah, I was there. I remember it well. And, you know, it is a tough time now, but we've been through that before, the Vietnam War, civil rights. You talked with Glenn about what he saw on the 1969, May 12th, we closed and everybody went home. Well, we're not even close to that now.
Right.
Although we are more polarized, it's more organized along conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican than it used to be. And that's what's changed so dramatically.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, here's a question which themes and touches into another theme I wanted to touch with you. This comes from Lauren in Alto Pass, which is a question for Mr. Jackson. Doctor, how do you know what the facts are in politics with the media being skewed by opinion? You know, with that in mind, I'm curious about this because this was on my agenda for you. The biggest threat I see in the future is something you and I have already kind of blushed against. And me, I call it the blatant misrepresentation of the truth, sophistry, ongoing intellectual dishonesty. That is what I see as the most troubling thing in the future. If we are a communication technology industry, dishonesty in the machine and garbage in, garbage out. I mean, how much does sophistry and what goes on in the media and being able to create good policy because there's so many fibs going on, where does that rank in your concerns for the future?
Well, it is definitely a problem, and we have to accept there are some scientific method standards that you must meet in order to declare something a fact. So it's not that you can have your facts and I can have mine. There are some basic facts. It takes facts to build a bridge. It takes facts to create an airplane that will stay in the air. So a lot of that's not even in dispute. But what is in dispute is the political spin. All politicians spin. They tell the story to help their cause. On the other hand, not all politicians blatantly lie. There's only a very small percentage that just don't respect objective reality. And we've got too much of that. They've got too much of a megaphone. I don't accept that all you get on the media is skewed or necessarily wrong. The media have some standards about what they do, what the journalists demand in order to have an objective story. And most media do that very, very carefully. I think you try to do that.
I try very hard.
In what you do. And I certainly think we teach in journalism, how do you write a fact-based story?
Who, what, when, or why?
I'm right? Sorry?
Who, what, when, or why?
Yes, basic. Right? Exactly. That's where you start.
That's where you start.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's interesting about this, these are not new problems that plague humanity, intellectual dishonesty, sophistry.
Yeah.
The Romans, Marcus Aurelius, in his 13 books, I mean, it's in all 13 books in some form or another, he tries to address that.
Well, and Plato with his shadows on the wall.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's always come back to this, you know, and I think it's interesting in that respect, but I got a lot of other stuff, maybe we get a chance, I want to get back to some of this. But you know, when it comes to higher education, 80% of colleges that closed between 2004 and 2020 were for-profit universities. Now, I mean, we've seen a lot of colleges close down. I'm wondering, yes or no, is college still worth the money? And especially in light of the student loan crisis, and you see some of the average debt that's there, how do you? I mean, a guy told me, he says, look, you know, if you're 19 years old and you go ask for $200,000 to buy a house, they're going to tell you no. You want to go, here's $180,000 to go to college, yes.
Well, college is not for everyone. I don't think everybody has to get a bachelor's degree, for example. I have great respect for vocational education. I have great respect for people who learn to do things that are useful. My dad was a plumber, for example, and those things are the kinds of things you've got to get done and don't require a college degree. But it used to be people who worked in automobile agencies, for example, they didn't have to have a degree. Now you got to know what computers are because they're running your cars. So these things change, and maybe not a degree, but the knowledge that we are doing in, say, automotive and airplanes is definitely something that you've got to have.
It's paying off when you look at the 200 guys that are over here, men and women who are servicing the jets at Southern Illinois Airport that learned aviation, you know, from SIU. Worked out for them, didn't it?
And even if you're going to be a person without a degree, and like my dad, a plumber, for example, my mother was a postal clerk, you're going to be a citizen. You're going to probably vote. You should be voting. You're going to have opinions that you share with your peers. And all of that can profit from some of the things that we teach when we get you up through at least a bachelor's degree. For many people, it is important to have a degree, and increasingly important.
Yeah, police. I mean, the standards have changed here now.
For police.
But I'm thinking really at this point, after listening to you, that it's not the people that needs to change, it's the education system that needs to change.
Well, I think you need to get a little of both. You need to get something that's going to get you a job and help you make a decent living. You also need to get the kind of education that makes you a good citizen and a good person and makes you a good family person.
I've had a lot of conversations with higher ed education saying, look, you know, there's a reason why we have music and poetry. There's more to life than in bridge engineering. You need to be, I always think of it as being a round person, rounded out in the most literal of senses. So you're saying yes, but what's the price tag?
Yeah.
And is it viable? And look on the other side and what's coming out the other side. Now, you and I, to a certain extent, grew up or were around you to a little more degree than myself, John, during a time where we were experiencing heady optimism about this country. And I can remember being part of that. Things are going to be better in the future. Domestic violence, crime will go down. We'll have safer this. We'll have safer that. We'll stop killing each other in the streets. I sometimes worry that we've gone backwards, especially these last maybe 10 years. I mean, you being an optimist, didn't you think as a species, as a culture, as an America, that we'd be further matured?
Well, if you look back to what we were just talking about, the 50s were very optimistic. We just come out of the war. Eisenhower was known for the sort of the optimism that he brought to the 50s.
Had the bomb and still optimistic.
Yeah, and, you know, the 50s, we were making that big comeback, and John Kennedy had that theme. And think about how many people, how much change has been brought by the Civil Rights Revolution, for example, how much getting rid of state-supported segregation has changed our country.
Happened on this date, 1964, when after an 83-day filibuster, Congress, Senate passed the 1964 Voting Rights Act. Happened on this date.
Yeah. Well, yeah, 64 and 65, both Lyndon Johnson accomplishments. And the way we treated women, you know, most women were not working, and now they are. And the way we treat people who are disabled, for example, all of that has changed for the good. And we're not going to go back on all of that, although there are some forces pushing some parts backward, in my estimation. But nevertheless, the great equation of when I go home to South Arkansas, we don't have segregated facilities. I grew up with white-only and colored-only fountains and restrooms in public facilities. So, you know, in the long sweep of things, we've come a long way, and we're not going to turn back. Now we still have an agenda, and we still have a lot of things yet to fix, but I don't think it's as bad as it was in the 40s and 50s when I grew up in the Deep South.
That's interesting. And you know why I take this from our earlier conversation of the round portion of being a person. Yeah, if you want to look at robberies or gun violence,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
if I want to take a slice, I can validate what we're doing worse. You take a look at everything, and now you're in a wheelchair and you don't have to worry about whether you can get into the courthouse or not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting in that perspective. So before I let you go, Dr. John Jackson, part of our emeritus interviews, a lifetime of learning, a lifetime of teaching, and teaching learns in your human experience. I wonder, what advice would you give me? If somebody's listening this morning and say, look, you know, I haven't learned a lot, but here's something you can take to the bank. I mean, can you distill a couple of items down for me, John, from your perspective? I'm more than a little curious.
Well, my perspective is one of public service. I think education is public service. I think media is a public service and public education. But think about ways in which you can do something for a bigger cause, things that you can serve the community, something you can volunteer for, something you can make a little contribution to making the community and other people's lives better. What have you got left over when you take care of the essentials that you can contribute to the greater good and the common good? That's a part of the preamble to the Constitution, and that's ambitious enough right there.
Buckminster Fuller said, you know, I changed, and this is after one of his children died, the way I can reach my maximum efficiency is by working on a scale that helps more people.
Wow, that's a good quote.
You know, and you were at the university when Buckminster Fuller was there, weren't you?
I was. I heard him speak.
Right? I mean, my friends who were there and with him and took care of him, since he can be a task, but then again, smart people usually can. with the exception of Dr. John Jackson, who, you know, I mean, that's one of the things in doing the research, the students that were so happy to have you as a teacher, my teacher.
Yeah, that's a great accolade.
That really is, once you put it in. Because when you were talking about the importance of teachers and the offers, I look back on my trajectory and I'm going, where would I be without them? And I do not like the answer. Teachers who took extra time in particular.
Well, it's an investment in the future, and that's a very satisfying thought that you've made an investment that is a part of other people's lives.
Dr. John Jackson. John, I really appreciate you coming in, and I really appreciate you spending all the time that you have in the past and helping explain things to me, too. You and I used to have a mutual friend. He's passed away since. He was on the faculty for many years, and I would very often complain to him the way that sometimes I complain to you. I said, you know, these people, we need to have term limits. We need to do that. You see what those guys did today?
That would be George Mace.
And that would be. And he'd calmly look at me and says, we do have term limits. They're called elections.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm like, okay, you're right. But, I mean, I think there, you know, there's more than one. You know, you look at that, you instantly knew, you know, we do have term limits. Mm-hmm. People are upset. Right. There's always something more to learn. Doc, really great to have you in. Dr. John Jackson.
I always enjoy it, Tom. Thanks for having me.